and wait while he went in to make his confession. Afterward, she could come in to kiss the shrine of St. Thomas. At that moment, an old monk wearing an ash-brown cowl came out of the chapel. He paused for a minute, smiled at the child, and pulled out some sacking and homespun rags that had been stuffed into a hole in the wall. He spread them out on the landing. "Sit down here. Then you won't be so cold," he said, and continued on down the stairs in his bare feet. Kristen was asleep when Father Martin, as the priest was called, came out to get her. From the church rose the loveliest song, and inside the chapel, candles burned on the altar. The priest gestured for Kristen to kneel beside her father, and then he took down a little golden reliquary that stood above the altar. He whispered to her that inside was a fragment of St. Thomas of Canterbury's bloody clothing, and he pointed to the holy image so that Kristen could press her lips to the feet. Lovely tones were still streaming from the church as they went downstairs. Father Martin told them that the organist was practicing while the schoolboys sang, but they had no time to listen, for Lavrans was hungry. He had fasted before confession. Now they would go over to the guest quarters at the canon's house to eat. Outside, the morning sun gleamed gold on the steep shores of distant Lake Mursa, so that all of the faded leafy groves looked like golden dust in the dark blue forests. The lake was rippled with little white specks of dancing foam. The wind blew cold and fresh, making the multicolored leaves float down onto the frost-covered hill. A group of horsemen appeared between the bishop's citadel and the house belonging to the Brothers of the Holy Cross. Lavran stepped aside and bowed with his hand to his breast as he nearly swept the ground with his hat. Then Kristen realized that the horseman in the fur cape had to be the bishop himself, and she sank in a curtsy almost to the ground. The bishop reined in his horse and greeted them in return, beckoning Lavrans to approach, and he spoke with him for a moment. Then Lavrans came back to the priest and the child and said,
"I have been invited to dine at the bishop's citadel. Do you think, Father Martin, that one of the canon's servants could accompany this little maiden home to Shoemaker Fartine's house, and tell my men that Halvdan should meet me here with Guldsvein at the hour of mid-afternoon prayers?"
The priest replied that this could easily be arranged. Then the barefoot monk who had spoken to Kristen in the tower stairway stepped forward and greeted them.
"There's a man over in our guest house who has business with the shoemaker anyway. He can take your message, Lavrans Björgovsson, and then your daughter can either go with him or stay at the cloister until you return. I'll see to it that she's given food over there."
Lavrans thanked him and said,
"It's a shame that you should be troubled with this child, Brother Edvin."
"Brother Edvin gathers up all the children he can," said Father Martin with a laugh. "Then he has someone to preach to."
"Yes, I don't dare offer you learned gentlemen here in Hamar my sermons," said the monk, smiling, and without taking offense. "I'm only good at talking to children and farmers, but that's no reason to tie a muzzle on the ox that threshes."
Kristen gave her father an imploring look. She thought there was nothing she would like better than to go with Brother Edvin. So Lavrans thanked him, and as her father and the priest followed the bishop's entourage, Kristen put her hand in the monk's, and they walked down toward the monastery, which was a cluster of wooden houses and a light-colored stone church all the way down near the water. Brother Edvin gave her hand a little squeeze, and when they glanced at each other, they both had to laugh. The monk was tall and gaunt, but quite stoop-shouldered. The child thought he looked like an old crane because his head was small, with a narrow, shiny, smooth pate above a bushy white fringe of hair, and perched on a long, thin, wrinkled neck. His nose was also as big and sharp as a beak, but there was something about him that made Kristen feel at ease and happy just by looking up into his long, furrowed face. His old, watery blue eyes were red-rimmed, and his eyelids were like thin brown membranes with thousands of wrinkles radiating from them. His hollow cheeks, with their reddish web of veins, were crisscrossed with wrinkles that ran down to his small, thin-lipped mouth.
But it looked as if Brother Edwin had become so wrinkled simply from smiling at people. Kristen thought she had never seen anyone who looked so cheerful or so kind. He seemed to carry within him a luminous and secret joy, and she was able to share it whenever he spoke. They walked along the fence of an apple orchard, where a few yellow and red fruits still hung on the trees. Two friars wearing black and white robes were raking withered beanstalks in the garden. The monastery was not much different from any other farm, and the guest house into which the monk escorted Kristen closely resembled a humble farmhouse, although there were many beds. In one of the beds lay an old man, and at the hearth sat a woman wrapping an infant in swaddling clothes. Two older children, a boy and a girl, stood near her. They complained, both the man and the woman, because they had not yet received their lunch.
"But they don't want to bring food to us twice, so here we sit and starve while you run around in town, Brother Edwin."
"Don't be so angry, Steinulf," said the monk. "Come over here, Kristen, and say hello. Look at this pretty maiden who is going to stay here today and eat with us."
He told Kristen that Steinulf had fallen ill on his way home from a meeting, and he had been allowed to stay in the cloister's guest house instead of the hospice because a kinswoman who was living at the hospice was so mean that he couldn't stand to be there.
"But I can tell they're getting tired of having me here," said the old man. "When you leave, Brother Edwin, no one will have time to take care of me, and then they'll probably make me go back to the hospice."
"Oh, you'll be well long before I'm done with my work at the church," said Brother Edwin. "Then your son will come to get you."
He took a kettle of hot water from the hearth and let Kristen hold it as he attended to Steinulf. Then the old man grew more tractable, and a moment later a monk came in, bringing food and drink for them. Brother Edwin said a prayer over the food and then sat down next to Steinulf on the edge of the bed so he could help the old man eat. Kristen sat down near the woman and fed the little boy, who was so small that he couldn't reach the porridge bowl, and who spilled whenever he tried to dip into the bowl of ale. The woman was from Hadelan, and had come with her husband and children to visit her brother, who was a monk at the cloister. But he was out wandering among the villages, and she complained bitterly about having to sit there wasting time. Brother Edwin spoke gently to the woman. She must not say that she was throwing her time away when she was here in the bishop's hamar. Here were all the splendid churches, and all day long the monks and canons celebrated Mass and chanted the offices of the day. And the town was so beautiful, even lovelier than Oslo itself, although it was somewhat smaller. But here, nearly every farm had a garden.
"You should have seen it when I arrived in the springtime," the monk said. "The whole town was white with flowers, and since then the sweetbriar roses have bloomed."
"Well, what good does that do me?" said the woman peevishly. "And it seems to me that there are more holy places here than holiness." The monk chuckled and shook his head. Then he rummaged around in his straw pallet and pulled out a big pile of apples and pears, which he shared among the children. Kristen had never tasted such luscious fruit. The juice ran out of her mouth with every bite she took. Then Brother Edwin had to go off to church, and he said that Kristen could come along. They cut across the cloister courtyard, and through a little side door they entered the church's choir. Construction was still going on at this church, too, and scaffolding had been set up at the juncture of the nave and the transept. Brother Edwin told Kristen that Bishop Ingjald was having the choir renovated and decorated. The bishop was immensely wealthy, and he used all of his riches to adorn the churches of the town. He was an excellent bishop and a good man. The friars of Olav's cloister were also good men, celibate, learned, and humble. It was a poor monastery, but they had received Brother Edwin kindly. His home was at the Minorite cloister in Oslo, but he had been given permission to beg for alms here in the Hamar diocese.
"Come over here," he said, leading Kristen to the foot of the scaffolding. He climbed up a ladder and rearranged several planks high above.
Then he went back down and helped the child to ascend. On the gray stone wall above her, Kristen saw strange flickering specks of light, red as blood and yellow as ale, blue and brown and green. She wanted to look behind her, but the monk whispered, "Don't turn around." When they stood together high up on the planks, he gently turned her around, and Kristen saw a sight so glorious that it almost took her breath away. Directly opposite her, on the south wall of the nave, stood a picture that glowed as if it had been made from nothing but glittering gemstones. The multicolored specks of light on the wall came from rays emanating from the picture itself. She and the monk were standing in the midst of its radiance. Her hands were red, as if she had dipped them in wine. The monk's face seemed to be completely gilded, and from his dark cowl, the colors of the picture were dimly reflected. She gave him a questioning glance, but he merely nodded and smiled. It was like standing at a great distance and looking into heaven. Behind a lattice of black lines, she began to distinguish, little by little, the Lord Jesus himself, wearing the costliest red cloak, the Virgin Mary in robes as blue as the sky, and the holy men and maidens in gleaming yellow and green and violet attire. They stood beneath the arches and pillars of illuminated houses, surrounded by intertwining branches and twigs with extraordinary bright leaves. The monk pulled her a little farther out toward the edge of the scaffold. "Stand here," he whispered. "Then the light will fall on you from Christ's own cloak." From the church below, the faint smell of incense and the odor of cold stone drifted up toward them. It was gloomy down below, but rays of sunlight were entering diagonally through a series of windows on the south wall of the nave. Kristen began to see that the heavenly picture must be some sort of window pane, for it filled that type of opening in the wall. The others were empty or closed off with panes of horn and wooden frames. A bird appeared, perched on the windowsill, chirped briefly, and then flew away. Outside the wall of the choir, the sound of metal on stone could be heard. Otherwise, everything was quiet. Only the wind came in small gusts, sighed a little between the church walls, and then died away.
"Well, well," said Brother Edvin with a sigh. "No one can make things like this in Norway. They may paint with glass in Nidaros, but not like this. But in the lands to the south, Kristen, in the great cathedrals, there they have picture panes as big as the portals of this church." Kristen thought about the pictures in the church back home. The altars of St. Olav and St. Thomas of Canterbury had paintings on the front panels and the tabernacles behind. But those pictures seemed dull to her and without radiance as she thought about them now. They climbed down the ladder and went up into the choir. There stood the altar, naked and bare, and on its stone top were stacked up small boxes and cups made of metal and wood and ceramic. Odd little knives, pieces of iron, and pens and brushes lay next to them. Then Brother Edvin told Kristen that these were his tools. He was skilled in the craft of painting pictures and carving tabernacles, and he had made the exquisite paintings that stood nearby on the choir chairs. They were intended for the front panels of the altars here in the friar's church. Kristen was allowed to watch as he mixed colored powders and stirred them in little ceramic cups, and she helped him carry the things over to a bench next to the wall. As the monk went from one painting to the next, sketching fine red lines in the fair hair of the holy men and women so curls and waves were made visible, Kristen followed close on his heels, watching him and asking questions, and the monk explained what he had painted. In one of the paintings, Christ sat on a golden chair, and St. Nicholas and St. Clement stood near him under a canopy. On either side was depicted the life of St. Nicholas. In one place he was an infant sitting on his mother's knee. He had turned away from the breast she offered him, for he was so holy, even in his cradle, that he refused to nurse more than once on Fridays.
Next to this was a picture of him placing the money bags at the door of the house where three maidens lived, who were so poor that they couldn't find husbands. Kristen saw how he cured the child of the Roman knight, and she saw the knight sail off in a boat with the false golden chalice in his hands. The knight had promised the holy bishop a golden chalice, which had been in his family for 1,000 years, as payment for returning the child to good health. But then he tried to betray St. Nikolaus by giving him a false golden chalice instead. That's why the boy fell into the sea with a real golden chalice in his hand. But St. Nikolaus carried the child unharmed beneath the water, and he emerged onto shore as his father stood in St. Nikolaus's church, offering the false goblet. All of this was shown in the picture, painted with gold and the most beautiful of colors. In another painting, the Virgin Mary sat with a Christ child on her knee. He had put one hand up under his mother's chin, and he was holding an apple in the other. With them stood Saint Suneva and Saint Christina. They were leaning gracefully from the hips, their faces a lovely pink and white, and they had golden hair and wore golden crowns. Brother Edvin gripped his right wrist with his left hand as he painted leaves and roses in their crowns.
"It seems to me that the dragon is awfully small," said Kristen, looking at the image of the saint who was her namesake. "It doesn't look as if it could swallow up the maiden."
"And it couldn't either," said Brother Edvin. "It was no bigger than that. Dragons and all other creatures that serve the devil only seem big as long as we harbor fear within ourselves. But if a person seeks God with such earnestness and desire that he enters into his power, then the power of the devil at once suffers such a great defeat that his instruments become small and impotent. Dragons and evil spirits shrink until they are no bigger than goblins and cats and crows. As you can see, the whole mountain that Saint Suneva was trapped inside is so small that it will fit on the skirt of her cloak."
"But weren't they inside the caves?" asked Kristen. "Saint Suneva and the Celia men? Isn't that true?"
The monk squinted at her and smiled again. "It's both true and not true. It seemed to be true for the people who found the holy bodies. And it seemed true to Suneva and the Celia men, because they were humble and believed that the world is stronger than all sinful people. They did not imagine that they might be stronger than the world because they did not love it. But if they had only known, they could have taken all the mountains and flung them out into the sea like tiny pebbles. No one and nothing can harm us, child, except what we fear and love."
"But what if a person doesn't fear and love God?" asked Kristen in horror.
The monk put his hand on her golden hair, gently tilted her head back, and looked into her face. His eyes were blue and open wide.
"There is no one, Kristen, who does not love and fear God. But it's because our hearts are divided between love for God and fear of the devil, and love for this world and this flesh, that we are miserable in life and death. For if a man knew no yearning for God and God's being, then he would thrive in hell, and we alone would not understand that he had found his heart's desire. Then the fire would not burn him if he did not long for coolness, and he would not feel the pain of the serpent's bite if he did not long for peace."
Kristen looked up into his face. She understood nothing of what he said. Brother Edvin continued,
"It was because of God's mercy toward us that he saw how our hearts were split, and he came down to live among us in order to taste, in fleshly form, the temptations of the devil when he entices us with power and glory, and the menace of the world when it offers us blows and contempt and the wounds of sharp nails in our hands and feet. In this manner he showed us the way and allowed us to see his love."
The monk looked down into the child's strained and somber face. Then he laughed a little and said in an entirely different tone of voice,
Do you know who was the first one to realize that our Lord had allowed himself to be born? It was the rooster. He saw the star, and then he said, and all the animals could speak Latin back then, he cried, Christus natus est!
Brother Edwin crowed out the last words, sounding so much like a rooster that Kristen ended up howling with laughter. And it felt so good to laugh, because all the strange things that he had just been talking about had settled upon her like a burden of solemnity. The monk laughed too.
It's true. Then when the ox heard about it, he began to bellow, Ubi, ubi, ubi. But the goat bleated and said, Bietlem, Bietlem, Bietlem. And the sheep was so filled with longing to see Our Lady and her son that he baaed at once, Eamus, Eamus. And the newborn calf lying in the straw got up and stood on his own legs. Volo, 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 he said. Haven't you heard this before? No, I should have known. I realize that he's a clever priest. That's Sira Eirik, who lives up there with you, and well-educated. But he probably doesn't know about this, because it's not something you learn unless you journey to Paris.
Have you been to Paris, then? Asked the child.
God bless you, little Kristen. I've been to Paris and traveled elsewhere in the world as well. And yet you mustn't think me any better for it, because I fear the devil and love and desire this world like a fool. But I hold on to the cross with all my strength. One must cling to it like a kitten hanging on to a plank when it falls into the sea. And what about you, Kristen? How would you like to offer up those lovely curls of yours and serve Our Lady like these brides that I've painted here?
There are no other children at home besides me, replied Kristen. So I will probably marry, I would think. Mother has already filled chests and trunks with my dowry.
Yes, I see, said Brother Edwin, stroking her forehead. That's the way folk dispatch their children these days. To God they give the daughters that are lame and blind and ugly and infirm. Or if they think he has given them too many children, they let him take some of them back. And yet, they wonder why the men and maidens who live in the cloisters are not all holy people.
Brother Edwin took Kristen into the sacristy and showed her the monastery's books, which were displayed on stands. They contained the most beautiful pictures. But when one of the monks came in, Brother Edwin said he was merely looking for a donkey's head to copy. Afterward, he shook his head at himself.
There you see my fear, Kristen. But they're so nervous about their books here in this house. If I had the proper faith and love, I wouldn't stand here and lie to Brother Ossulf. But then I could just as well take these old leather gloves and hang them up on that ray of sunshine over there.
Kristen went with the monk over to the guest house and had something to eat. But otherwise she sat in the church all day long, watching him work and talking to him. And not until Lavrans came back to get Kristen did either she or the monk remember the message that should have been sent to the shoemaker. Kristen remembered those days she spent in Hamar better than anything else she experienced on that long journey. Oslo was no doubt larger than Hamar, but since she had already seen a town, it did not seem so extraordinary to her. Nor did she think Skog was as beautiful as Urengard, even though the buildings were finer. She was glad she wasn't going to live there. The manor was set on a hill, and below lay Botten Fjord, gray and melancholy with black forests, while on the opposite shore and beyond the buildings, the sky reached all the way down to the tops of the trees. There were no towering or steep mountainsides like those back home to lift the sky high overhead, or to soften and frame the view, so that the world was neither too big nor too small. The journey home was cold. It was almost Advent, and when they had traveled a short distance into the valley, they came upon snow. They had to borrow sleighs and ride for most of the way. The exchange of estates was handled in such a manner that Lavrans turned over Skog to his brother Osman, but retained the right of repurchase for himself and his descendants. Chapter 3. In the spring after Kristin's long journey, Ronfrid gave birth to a daughter. Both parents had no doubt wished that the child would be a boy, but this did not trouble them for long, and they developed the deepest love for little Ulvil. She was an exceedingly pretty child, healthy, good-natured, happy, and serene. Ronfrid loved this new child so much that she continued to nurse her even after she turned 2. For that reason, Ronfrid followed Sira Eirik's advice and refrained from participating in her usual strict fasts and devout rituals for as long as she had the child at her breast. Because of this, and because of her joy for Ulvil, Ronfrid blossomed, and Lavran thought he had never seen his wife look so happy and beautiful and approachable in all the years of their marriage. Kristin also felt it was a great joy that they had been given her little infant sister. She had never thought about the fact that her mother's somber disposition had made life at home so subdued. She thought things were as they should be. Her mother disciplined or admonished her, while her father teased and played with her. Now her mother was gentler toward her and gave her more freedom. She caressed her more often too, so Kristin didn't notice that her mother also had less time to spend with her. She loved Ulvil, as everyone did, and was pleased when she was allowed to carry her sister or rock her cradle. And later on, the little one was even more fun. As she began to crawl and walk and talk, Kristin could play with her. In this manner, the people of Urengard enjoyed 3 good years. Good fortune was also with them in many ways, and Lavrans did a great deal of construction and made improvements on the estate. The buildings and stables had been old and small when he came to Urengard, since the Yeslings had leased out the farm for several generations. Then came Whitsuntide of the 3rd year. At that time, Ronfrid's brother Tron Iverson of Sunbu and his wife Gudri and their 3 small sons were visiting. One morning, the grown-ups were sitting on the loft gallery talking, while the children played in the courtyard. There, Lavrans had started building a new house, and the children were climbing up onto the timbers that had been brought by wagon. One of the Yesling boys had hit Ulvil and made her cry, so Tron went down and scolded his son as he picked Ulvil up in his arms. She was the prettiest and most amenable child that one could imagine, and her uncle had great affection for her, although he was not usually very fond of children. At that moment, a man came walking across the courtyard from the barnyard, leading a huge black ox. But the ox was mean and intractable, and it tore away from the man. Tron leaped up on top of the pile of timbers, chasing the older children ahead of him. But he was carrying Ulvil in one arm, and he had his youngest son by the hand. A log suddenly rolled beneath his feet, and Ulvil fell from his grasp and down the hill. The log slid after her and then rolled until it came to rest on the child's back. Lavrans dashed down from the gallery at once. He came racing over and tried to lift the log. Suddenly, the ox charged toward him. He grabbed for its horns, but he was knocked off his feet. Then he managed to seize hold of its nostrils, pulled himself halfway up, and held on to the ox until Tron recovered from his confusion, and the men who came running from the house threw harnesses over the animal. Ronfrid was on her knees, trying to raise the log. Lavrans lifted it enough so that she could pull the child out and place her on her lap. The little girl whimpered terribly when they touched her, but Ronfrid sobbed loudly. "She's alive, thank God. She's alive." It was a great miracle that Ulvil had not been crushed. The log had fallen in such a way that it had come to rest with one end lying on top of a rock in the grass. When Lavrans straightened up, blood ran from his mouth, and his clothes had been ripped to shreds across his chest from the ox's horns. Tordis came running with a sheet made from hides, Carefully, she and Ronfrid lifted the child onto it, but she sounded as if she was suffering intolerable pain at even the slightest touch. Ronfrid and Tortoise carried her into the winter house. Kristen stood pale and rigid on the pile of timbers. The little boys clung to her, crying. All the servants of the farm had now gathered in the courtyard, the women weeping and wailing. Lavrans ordered them to saddle Guldsvein and one more horse. But when Arna brought the horses, Lavrans fell to the ground when he tried to mount. Then he ordered Arna to ride over to the priest, while Halfdan would travel south to bring back a wise woman who lived near the place where the rivers converged. Kristen saw that her father's face was grayish-white. He had bled so much that his light blue clothing was completely covered with reddish-brown spots. Suddenly, he straightened up, tore an axe out of the hands of one of the men, and strode over to where several servants were still holding on to the ox. He struck the beast between the horns with the blade of the axe so that the ox sank to its knees. But Lavrans kept on hammering away until blood and brains were spattered everywhere. Then he was seized by a coughing fit and fell backward onto the ground. Tron and one of the men had to carry him inside. Kristen thought her father was dead. She screamed loudly and ran after him as she called to him with all her heart. Inside the winter house, Ulvil had been placed on her parents' bed. All of the pillows had been thrown to the floor so that the child could lie flat. It looked as if she had already been laid out on the straw of her deathbed. But she was moaning loudly and incessantly, and her mother was leaning over her, stroking and patting her, wild with grief because there was nothing she could do. Lavrans was lying on the other bed. He got up and staggered across the floor to console his wife. Then she sprang up and screamed, "Don't touch me! Don't touch me! Jesus! Jesus, I am so worthless that you should strike me dead. Will there never be an end to the misfortune I bring upon you?" "You haven't. My dear wife, this is not something you have brought upon us," said Lavrans, placing a hand on her shoulder. She shuddered at his touch, and her pale gray eyes glistened in her gaunt, sallow face. "No doubt she means that I am the one who caused this," said Tron Iverson harshly. His sister shot him a look of hatred and replied, "Tron knows what I mean." Kristen ran to her parents, but they both pushed her aside, and Tortoise, who came over with a kettle of hot water, took her gently by the shoulders and said, "Go over to our house, Kristen. You're in the way here." Tortoise wanted to attend to Lavrans, who was sitting on the step of the bed, but he told her that he was not gravely wounded. "But can't you ease Ulvil's pain a little? God help us, her moans could arouse pity from the stone inside the mountain."
"We don't dare touch her until the priest arrives, or Ingiar, the wise woman," said Tortoise.
Arna came in just then and reported that Cirra Eirik was not at home. Ronfrid stood there for a moment, wringing her hands. Then she said,
"Send word to Fru Osil at Haugen. Nothing else matters if only Ulvil can be saved."
No one paid any attention to Kristen. She crept up onto the bench behind the headboard of the bed, tucked up her legs, and rested her head on her knees. Now she felt as if her heart were being crushed between hard fists. Fru Osil was going to be summoned. Her mother had never wanted them to send for Fru Osil, not even when she herself was near death when she gave birth to Ulvil, nor when Kristen was so ill with fever. People said she was a witch. The Bishop of Oslo and the canons of the cathedral had sat in judgment on her. She would have been executed or burned at the stake if she hadn't been of such high birth that she was like a sister to Queen Ingeborg. But people said that she had poisoned her first husband, and that she had won her present husband, Herr Bjorn, through witchcraft. He was young enough to be her son. She did have children, but they never came to visit their mother. So those two high-born people, Bjorn and Osil, sat on their small farm in Dovre, having lost all their riches. None of the gentry in the valley would have anything to do with them, but secretly people sought out Fru Osil's advice. Poor folk even went to her openly with their troubles and ills. They said she was kind, but they were also afraid of her. Kristen thought that her mother, who was otherwise constantly praying, should have called on God and the Virgin Mary instead. She tried to pray herself, especially to Saint Olaf, for she knew that he was kind and he had helped so many who suffered from illness and wounds and broken bones, but she couldn't collect her thoughts. Her parents were now alone in the room. Lavrans was lying on the bed again, and Ronfrid sat leaning over the injured child, occasionally wiping Ulvil's forehead and hands with a damp cloth and moistening her lips with wine. A long time passed. Tordis looked in on them now and then. She wanted so desperately to help, but each time Ronfrid sent her away. Kristen wept soundlessly and prayed in silence, but every once in a while she would think about the witch, and she waited tensely to see her enter the room. Suddenly Ronfrid broke the silence. "Are you asleep, Lavrans?"
"No," replied her husband. "I'm listening to Ulvil. God will help his innocent lamb, my wife. We mustn't doubt that. But it's hard to lie here and wait."
"God hates me for my sins," said Ronfrid in despair. "My children are in peace where they are. I don't dare doubt that. And now Ulvil's time has come too. But he has cast me out, for my heart is a viper's nest of sin and sorrow."
Just then the door opened. Sira Eirik stepped inside, straightening up his enormous body as he stood in the doorway, and pronounced in his deep, clear voice, "God help those in this house." The priest placed the box containing his medical things on the step of the bed, went over to the hearth, and poured warm water over his hands. Then he pulled out his cross, raised it to all four corners of the room, and murmured something in Latin. After that, he opened the smoke vent so that light could stream into the room. Then he went over and looked at Ulvil. Kristen was afraid that he would discover her and chase her away. Usually, very little escaped Sira Eirik's eye. But he didn't look around. The priest took a vial out of his box, poured something onto a tuft of finely carded wool, and placed it over Ulvild's nose and mouth.
"Soon her suffering will lessen," said the priest.
He went over to Lavrans and attended to him as he asked them to tell him how the accident had occurred. Lavrans had two broken ribs and he had received a wound to his lungs, but the priest didn't think he was in danger.
"What about Ulvil?"
asked her father sorrowfully.
"I'll tell you after I have examined her," replied the priest, "but you must go up to the loft and rest. We need quiet here and more room for those who will take care of her."
He put Lavran's arm around his shoulder, lifted up the man, and helped him out. Kristen would have preferred to go with her father, but she didn't dare show herself. When Sira Eirik returned, he didn't speak to Ronfrid, but cut the clothes off Ulvil, who was now whimpering less and seemed to be half asleep. Cautiously, he ran his hands over the child's body and limbs.
"Are things so bad for my child, Eirik, that you don't know what to do? Is that why you have nothing to say?"
asked Ronfrid in a subdued voice. The priest replied softly,
"It looks as if her back is badly injured, Ronfrid. I don't know anything else to do except to let God and Saint Olaf prevail. There's not much I can do here."
The mother said vehemently,
"Then we must pray. You know that Lavrans and I will give everything you ask for, sparing nothing, if you can convince God to allow Ulvil to live."
"I think it would be a miracle," said the priest, "if she were to live and regain her health."
"But aren't you always talking about miracles both day and night? Don't you think a miracle could happen for my child?"
she said in the same tone of voice.
"It's true that miracles do occur," said the priest. "But God does not grant everyone's prayers. We do not know his mysterious ways. And don't you think it would be worse for this pretty little maiden to grow up crippled and lame?"
Ronfrid shook her head and cried softly.
I have lost so many, priest. I cannot lose her too.
I'll do everything I can, replied the priest, and pray with all my might. But you must try, Ronfrid, to bear whatever fate God visits upon you.
The mother murmured softly, Never have I loved any of my children as I have loved this one. If she too is taken from me, I think my heart will break.
God help you, Ronfrid Evers' daughter, said Sirrah Eirik, shaking his head. You want nothing more from all your prayers and fasting than to force your will on God. Does it surprise you, then, that it has accomplished so little good?
Ronfrid gave the priest a stubborn look and said, I have sent for Fru Asil.
Well, you may know her, but I do not, said the priest.
I will not live without Ulvil, said Ronfrid in the same voice as before. If God won't help her, then I will seek the aid of Fru Asil, or offer myself up to the devil if he will help.
The priest looked as if he wanted to make a sharp retort, but he restrained himself. He leaned down and touched the injured girl's limbs again. Her hands and feet are cold, he said. We must put some kegs of hot water next to her, and then you must not touch her again until Fru Asil arrives.
Kristen soundlessly slipped down onto the bench and pretended to sleep. Her heart was pounding with fear. She had not understood much of the conversation between Sirrah Eirik and her mother, but it had frightened her greatly, and she knew it wasn't meant for her ears. Her mother stood up to get the kegs. She then broke down, sobbing. Pray for us nevertheless, Sirrah Eirik. A little while later, her mother came back with Tordis. The priest and the women bustled around Ulvil, and then Kristen was discovered and sent away. The light dazzled Kristen as she stood in the courtyard. She thought that most of the day had passed while she sat in the dark winter house, but the buildings were light gray and the grass was shimmering, as glossy as silk in the white midday sun. Beyond the golden lattice of the alder thicket, with its tiny new leaves, the river glinted. It filled the air with its cheerful, monotonous roar, for it flowed strongly down a flat, rocky riverbed near Urengard. The mountainsides rose up in a clear blue haze, and the streams leaped down the slopes through melting snow. The sweet, strong spring outside made Kristen weep with sorrow at the helplessness she felt all around her. No one was in the courtyard, but she heard people talking in the servants' room. Fresh earth had been spread over the spot where her father had killed the ox. She didn't know what to do with herself. Then she crept behind the wall of the new building, which had been raised to a height of a couple of logs. Inside were Ulvil's and her playthings. She gathered them up and put them into a hole between the lowest log and the foundation. Lately, Ulvil had wanted all of Kristen's toys, and that had made her unhappy at times. She thought now that if her sister got well, she would give her everything she owned. And that thought comforted her a little. Kristen thought about the monk at Hamar. He, at least, was convinced that miracles could happen for everyone. But Sirrah Eirik was not as sure of it, nor were her parents. And they were the ones she was most accustomed to listening to. It fell like a terrible burden upon her when she realized for the first time that people could have such different opinions about so many things. And not just evil, godless people disagreeing with good people, but also good people such as Brother Edvin and Sirrah Eirik, or her mother and father. She suddenly realized that they too thought differently about many things. Tordis found Kristen asleep there in the corner late in the day, and she took her indoors. The child hadn't eaten a thing since morning. Tordis kept vigil with Ronfrid over Ulvil that night, and Kristen lay in her bed with Jan, Tordis's husband, and Ivan and Orm, her little boys. The smell of their bodies, the man snoring, and even the breathing of the two children made Kristen quietly weep. Only the night before she had lain in bed, as she had every night of her life,
with her own father and mother and little Ulvil. It was like thinking about a nest that had been torn apart and scattered, and she herself had been flung from the shelter and wings that had always warmed her. At last she cried herself to sleep, alone and miserable among all those strangers. On the following morning when Kristen got up, she learned that her uncle and his entire entourage had left Urengard in anger. Tron had called his sister a crazy, demented woman and her husband a spineless fool who had never learned to rein in his wife. Kristen grew flushed with rage, but she was also ashamed. She realized that a grave impropriety had taken place when her mother had driven her closest kinsman from the manor. And for the first time, it occurred to Kristen that there was something about her mother that was not as it should be, that she was different from other women. As she stood and pondered this, a maidservant came up to her and asked her to go up to the loft to her father. But when she stepped into the loft room, Kristen forgot all about tending to him. For across from the open doorway, with the light shining directly in her face, sat a small woman, whom she realized must be the witch, although Kristen had not expected her to look like that. She seemed as small as a child, and delicate, for she was sitting in the big, high-backed chair that had been brought up to the room. A table had also been placed in front of her, covered with Ronfrid's finest embroidered linen cloth. Pork and fowl were set forth on silver platters. There was wine in a bowl of curly birchwood, and she had Lavron's own silver goblet to drink from. She had finished eating and was wiping her small, slender hands on one of Ronfrid's best towels. Ronfrid herself stood in front of her, holding a brass basin of water. Fru Osil let the towel drop into her lap, smiled at the child, and said in a lovely, clear voice, "Come over here to me." And to Kristen's mother she said, "You have beautiful children, Ronfrid." Her face was full of wrinkles, but pure white and pink like a child's, and her skin looked as if it were just as soft and fine to the touch. Her lips were as red and fresh as a young woman's, and her big hazel eyes gleamed. An elegant white linen wimple framed her face and was fastened tightly under her chin with a gold brooch. Over it, she wore a veil of soft, dark blue wool, which fell loosely over her shoulders and onto her dark, well-fitting clothes. She sat as erect as a candle, and Kristen sensed rather than thought that she had never seen such a beautiful or noble woman as this old witch whom the gentry of the village refused to have anything to do with. Fru Osil held Kristen's hand in her own soft old hands. She spoke to her kindly and with humor, but Kristen could not find a word to reply. Fru Osil said to Ronfrid with a little laugh, "Do you think she's afraid of me?"
"No, no,"
Kristen almost shouted. Fru Osil laughed even more and said, "She has wise eyes, this daughter of yours, and good strong hands. And she's not accustomed to slothfulness either, I can see. You're going to need someone who can help you care for Ulvil when I'm not here. So you can let Kristen assist me while I'm at the manor. She's old enough for that, isn't she? 11 years old? Then Fru Osil left, and Kristen was about to follow her. But Lavrans called to her from his bed. He was lying flat on his back with pillows stuffed under his knees. Fru Osil had ordered him to lie in this manner so that the injury to his chest would heal faster.
"You're going to get well soon, aren't you, father?"
asked Kristen, using the formal means of address. Lavrans looked up at her. Never before had she addressed him in that manner. Then he said somberly,
"I'm not in danger, but it's much more serious for your sister."
"I know," said Kristen with a sigh.
Then she stood next to his bed for a while. Her father did not speak again, and Kristen could find nothing more to say. And when Lavrans told her sometime later to go downstairs to her mother and Fru Osil, Kristen hurried out and rushed across the courtyard to the winter house. Chapter 4 Fru Asiel stayed at Jorungard for most of the summer, which meant that people came there to seek her advice. Kristen heard Sira Eirik speak jeeringly of this, and it dawned on her that her parents did not much care for it either. But she pushed aside all thoughts of these things, nor did she pay any heed to what her own opinion of Fru Asiel might be. She was her constant companion, and never tired of listening to and watching the woman. Ulvil still lay stretched out flat on her back in the big bed. Her small face was white to the very edge of her lips, and she had dark circles under her eyes. Her lovely blonde hair smelled sharply of sweat because it hadn't been washed in such a long time. It had turned dark and had lost its sheen and curl so that it looked like old, wind-blown hay. She looked tired and tormented and patient, and she would smile, feeble and wan, whenever Kristen sat by her on the bed to talk, and to show her all the lovely presents she had received from her parents and their friends and kinsmen far and wide. There were dolls, toy birds and cattle, a little board game, jewelry, velvet caps, and colorful ribbons. Kristen had put it all in a box for her. Ulvil would look at everything with her somber eyes, sigh, and then let the treasures fall from her weary hands. But whenever Fru Asiel came over to her, Ulvil's face would light up with joy. Eagerly she drank the refreshing and sleep-inducing brews that Fru Asiel prepared for her. She never complained when the woman tended to her, and she would lie still, listening happily, whenever Fru Asiel played Lavrun's harp and sang. She knew so many ballads that were unfamiliar to the people there in the valley. Often she would sing for Kristen when Ulvil had fallen asleep. And sometimes she spoke of her youth, when she lived in the south of the country and frequented the courts of King Magnus and King Eirik and their queens. Once, as they were sitting there and Fru Asiel was telling stories, Kristen blurted out what she had thought about so often.
It seems strange to me that you're always so happy, when you've been used to...
She broke off, blushing. Fru Asiel looked down at the child, smiling. You mean because now I'm separated from all those things? She laughed quietly, and then she said, I've had my glory days, Kristen, but I'm not foolish enough to complain because I have to be content with sour, watered-down milk now that I've drunk up all my wine and ale. Good days can last a long time if one tends to things with care and caution. All sensible people know that.
That's why I think that sensible people have to be satisfied with the good days,
for the grandest of days are costly indeed. They call a man a fool who fritters away his father's inheritance in order to enjoy himself in his youth. Everyone is entitled to his own opinion about that. But I call him a true idiot and fool only if he regrets his actions afterward. And he is twice the fool and the greatest buffoon of all if he expects to see his drinking companions again once the inheritance is gone.
Is something wrong with Ulvil?
Fru Asiel asked gently, turning to Ronfrid, who had given a start from her place near the child's bed.
No, she's sleeping quietly, said the mother as she came over to Fru Asiel and Kristen, who were sitting near the hearth.
With her hand on the smoke-vent pole, Ronfrid stood and looked down into the woman's face.
Kristen doesn't understand all this, she said.
No, replied Fru Asiel. But she also learned her prayers before she understood them. At those times when one needs either prayers or advice, one usually has no mind to learn or to understand. Ronfrid raised her black eyebrows thoughtfully. When she did that, her light, deep-set eyes looked like lakes beneath a black forest meadow. That's what Kristen used to think when she was small. Or perhaps she had heard someone say that. Fru Asiel looked at her with that little half-smile of hers. Ronfrid sat down at the edge of the hearth, picked up a twig, and poked at the embers.
But the person who has wasted his inheritance on the most wretched of goods, and then later sees a treasure he would give his life to own, don't you think that he would deplore his own stupidity?
No bargain is without some loss, Ronfrid, said Fru Asil. And whoever wishes to give his life must take the risk and see what he can win.
Ronfrid jerked the burning twig from the fire, blew out the flame, and curled her hand around the glowing end so that a blood-red light shone between her fingers. Oh, it's all nothing but words, 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 Fru Asil.
There is very little worth paying for so dearly, Ronfrid, said the other woman, as with one's own life.
Yes, there is, said Kristen's mother fervently. My husband, she whispered almost inaudibly.
Ronfrid, said Fru Asil quietly, many a maiden has had the same thought when she was tempted to bind a man to her and give up her maidenhood to do so. But haven't you read about men and maidens who gave God all they owned and entered cloisters or stood naked in the wilderness and then regretted it afterward? They're called fools in the holy books. And it would certainly be a sin to think that God was the one who would deceive them in their bargain.
Ronfrid sat quite still for a moment. Then Fru Asil said,
Come along with me, Kristen. It's time to go out and collect the dew that we'll use to wash Ulvil in the morning.
Outside, the courtyard was white and black in the moonlight. Ronfrid accompanied them through the farmyard down to the gate near the cabbage garden. Kristen saw the thin silhouette of her mother leaning against the fence nearby. The child shook dew from the large, ice-cold cabbage leaves and from the folds of the lady's mantle into her father's silver goblet. Fru Asil walked silently at Kristen's side. She was there only to protect her, for it was not wise to let a child go out alone on such a night. But the dew would have more power if it was collected by an innocent maiden. When they came back to the gate, Ronfrid was gone. Kristen was shaking with cold as she put the icy silver goblet into Fru Asil's hands. In her wet shoes, she ran over to the loft where she slept with her father. She had her foot on the first step when Ronfrid emerged from the shadows beneath the gallery of the loft. In her hands, she held a bowl of steaming liquid.
I've warmed up some ale for you, daughter, said Ronfrid.
Kristen thanked her gratefully and put her lips to the rim. Then her mother asked,
Kristen, those prayers and other things that Fru Asil is teaching you, is there anything sinful or ungodly about them?
I can't believe that, replied the child. They all mention Jesus and the Virgin Mary and the names of the saints.
What has she been teaching you? Asked her mother again.
Oh, about herbs, and how to ward off bleeding and warts and strained eyes, and moths in clothing, and mice in the storehouse, and which herbs to pick in sunlight, and which ones have power in the rain. But I mustn't tell the prayers to anyone else, or they will lose their power, she said quickly.
Her mother took the empty bowl and set it on the steps. Suddenly, she threw her arms around her daughter, pulled her close, and kissed her. Kristen noticed that her mother's cheeks were hot and wet.
May God and Our Lady guard and protect you against all evil. We have only you now, your father and I. You're the only one that misfortune has not touched. My dear, my dear, never forget that you are your father's dearest joy.
Ronfrid went back to the winter house, undressed, and crawled into bed with Ulvil. She put her arm around the child and pressed her face close to the little one's so that she could feel the warmth of Ulvil's body and smell the sharp odor of sweat from the child's damp hair. Ulvil slept soundly and securely as always after Fru Asil's evening potion. There was a soothing scent from the Virgin Mary grass spread under the sheet. And yet Ronfrid lay there for a long time, unable to sleep, and stared up at the little scrap of light in the roof,
where the moon shone on the horn pane of the smoke vent. Fru Asiel lay in the other bed, but Ronfrid never knew whether she was asleep or awake. Fru Asiel never mentioned that they had known each other in the past, and that frightened Ronfrid quite badly. She thought she had never felt so bitterly sad or in such an agony of fear as she did.